This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 1 Samuel. Today, Pastor Sandy will be teaching through 1 Samuel chapters 4 through 7.
You know, professional baseball players are notoriously superstitious. The story is told of the 1954 New York Giants. During a 16-game winning streak, the team refused to wash their uniforms. For more than 2 weeks, the Giants played with dirty unis, lest they wash off their good luck. Hall of Fame player Honus Wagner believed that every bat held only 100 hits. After 100 hits, he retired the bat, even a perfectly good bat. He was done with it. Every bat only had 100 hits. In 1993, when Ricky Henderson was traded to the Blue Jays, he paid another player $25,000 to give up jersey number 24 so he could wear his lucky number. Former Colorado Rockies outfielder Larry Walker used to have a fixation with the number 3. He wore the jersey 33. He took 3 swings before he stepped into the batter's box. In the locker room, he always showered under the 3rd nozzle. He set his alarm for 3 minutes past the hour. And he was married on November the 3rd at 3:33 p.m. After Giants infielder Jim Davenport hit 2 home runs in a game, he noticed that he had failed to button one of the buttons on his shirt. He had missed a button. And for the rest of his career, he left that same buttonhole empty every game. The way he buttoned his shirt became a superstition. For some baseball players, good luck charms are as important as bats and gloves. A coin or a chain or a rabbit's foot or a medal or a rock they carry with them. The player hopes by carrying it, it'll conjure up some good luck for them. It seems so silly to me to put your trust in a rabbit's foot, especially since it didn't help the rabbit very much. Superstition, though, explains what happened to Israel in 1 Samuel chapter 4. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel, and now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. For a time, during the period of the judges, the Philistines dominated southern Israel. The Philistines were Europeans who had sailed from the island of Crete. They were called the Sea People. The Philistines initially tried to invade Egypt, but they were turned back. And instead, they settled a little bit north of Egypt along the Mediterranean coast in what is today southern Israel. They organized into 5 city-states: Gaza, Gath, Ekron, Ashkelon, and Ashdod. Israel fought on equal terms with the Ammonites and the Moabites, but the Philistines had a military advantage. They had imported iron weapons from Greece, armor and helmets and spears and swords and shields. The Philistines were the first people in Canaan to possess iron weapons, and the technology allowed the Philistines to dominate Israel. You know, often people mistake today's Palestinians as ancestors of the Philistines. Not so. The Palestinians are Arabs. The Philistines were actually Greeks. The name Palestine was actually an invention of the Romans. When they conquered the land of Israel, when they conquered the Jews in the 1st century AD, they renamed Israel after the Hebrews' ancient enemy, the Philistines. It was a way of pouring salt in the wound, of expressing disdain and insulting Israel. I'm sure today's Palestinians have the same disdain for Israel and would like to dominate Israel as did the Philistines, but there is no genetic relation between the two. On a sidebar, most ancient people viewed dogs as predators, as unwanted animals. You would never see a dog as a pet. But a dog cemetery was recently unearthed in the Philistine city of Ashkelon. Evidently, the Philistines were one of the first peoples to domesticate dogs. Well, Israel encamped beside Ebenezer, And the Philistines encamped in Aphek. Aphek was east of the modern city of Tel Aviv near Joppa. Then the Philistines put themselves in battle array against Israel. The Philistines were definitely the aggressors. Their army had pushed their way into Israeli territory. And when they joined battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. It was a devastating loss and defeat. And when the people who came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" They couldn't figure it out. "Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." The bloodied and beaten Israelis, they called for backup. But rather than crying out to the Lord, they brought up the Ark of the Lord. Rather than trust in God Himself, they put their trust in the things of God. I call it a case of misplaced faith. So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. Now, at this particular time, the tabernacle was in Shiloh, and in its innermost sanctum sat the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark was the centerpiece of the Holy of Holies. You remember we studied this. The Ark was a rectangular box, roughly 4 foot long by 2 foot high by 2 foot deep. In the Ark, there were three items: the two tablets of the Ten Commandments, a jar of manna, and the rod of Aaron that had budded with almond blossoms to confirm his priesthood. The Ark was plated with gold, and its lid, called the mercy seat, was made of solid gold. On top of it, it was adorned with two cherubim or angels. The lid of the Ark served as God's throne in the tabernacle, and over the Ark rested the literal, tangible, visible presence of God, the manifestation of God on earth in the temple. Obviously, the Ark of the Covenant represented God to the people of Israel. But the men of Israel made a fatal mistake. They assumed that the Ark had powers of its own. Israel must have watched the movie Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. And they saw how that the Ark burned the Nazi swastika off the side of the wooden crate. You remember that in the movie? They confused the movies for the Bible. The Ark itself was nothing but a box. And yet the superstitious Hebrews treated it like a four-leaf clover, or like a rabbit's foot, or like the number 33, or like a dirty uniform. To the Israelis, it was just a good luck charm. And this mistake is not unique to the Hebrews of old. People today, too, are guilty of putting their trust in the things of God rather than in God Himself. Faith often gets confused with superstition. You see, superstition is the manipulation of inanimate objects in an attempt to direct the purposeless powers of chance, whereas faith is confidence in the living God, who has a mind of His own and who orchestrates situations to accomplish His purposes. There's a big difference. Don't you be guilty of a misplaced faith. Just carrying a Bible does you no good. Just because you got a Bible under your arm doesn't mean that the Bible itself has some kind of magical power. Just carrying a Bible does you no good. You got to read it. Just making an appearance at church is of value only if you worship while you're there. Christian relics or music or art might remind us of God's presence, but they should never take His place. They have no power of their own. Don't mistake the things of God for God Himself. It's been said no one is so thoroughly superstitious as the godless man. But tragically, this was Israel's error. Verse 5, "And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. The roar of the crowd, it sounded like a thunderclap. Now, when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, 'What does the sound of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?' Then they understood that the ark of the Lord had come into the camp. And so the Philistines were afraid, for they said, God has come into the camp. Notice the Philistines were also superstitious. They too mistook God for the things of God, but they were pagans. You could expect that from the Philistines. The Israelis needed to act differently. They should have known better. And they said, woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us. Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. It's interesting. The Philistines feared the God of Israel. At the Exodus, God had made a name for himself among the nations. Egypt's neighbors had set up and they had taken notice of God's mighty power. Here they're recalling God's demonstration of power in the wilderness. And the Philistines, though, they encourage each other here in verse 9. They say, be strong and conduct yourself like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight. And verse 10 reveals what happens to God's people when they possess a misplaced faith. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. And I'm sure the Hebrews didn't think it could get any worse, but it did. Also, the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. In the late 1970s, Israeli archaeologists were digging in a grain silo at Isbet Sarte when they found a piece of pottery, a pottery shard that contained, on the pottery shard, were inscribed five lines. On those five lines, we find writing that recounts this story. Extra-biblical archaeological evidence substantiating the biblical account provides some amazing evidence for the Bible's historicity. Well, then a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line the same day, and he came to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. These were obviously signs of mourning. Now, when he came, there was Eli. You remember the high priest, Eli, Samuel's mentor, sitting on a seat by the wayside watching. For his heart trembled for the ark of God. He was more concerned for the ark than he was his two sons. And when the man came into the city and told it, all the city cried out, oh my, the news of this defeat reaches Shiloh. And the crowd that had shouted now shudders. We've been defeated. The ark has been taken. Hophni and Phinehas are dead. When Eli heard noise of the outcry, he said, what does the sound of this tumult mean? And the man came quickly and told Eli, and the news became a death blow. Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were so dim that he could not see. Then the man said to Eli, I am he who came from the battle, and I fled today from the battle line. And he said, what happened, my son? And so the messenger answered and said, Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has been a great slaughter among the people. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And here are the words that did it, that did him in. And the ark of God has been captured. And when he heard that the ark had been captured, then it happened when he made mention of the ark of God that Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for the man was old and heavy. The priest was so fat that when he fell off the stump, the weight of his body broke his neck and he died instantly. Another reason to lose a little weight. And Eli's obituary appears in verse 18, and he had judged Israel 40 years. But Eli was not the only person shaken up by the news of the ark's capture. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was with child, due to be delivered. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed herself and gave birth, for her labor pains came upon her. This troublesome news triggered her labor. And about the time of her death, the women who stood by her said to her, "Do not fear, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer, nor did she regard it. And then she named the child Ichabod. And the word Ichabod means no glory, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." She names her boy No Glory. And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." What a tragedy when the glory of God departs from a life, or from a ministry, or from a church, or from a community, or from a nation. And yet God, over the centuries, has had to write Ichabod above the door time and time again. You see, here is the result of a misplaced faith. Death ensues and God's glory departs. Faith is not superstition. God wants us to trust in Him, not in reminders of Him or relics about Him or rituals from Him. God wants us to trust in Him. And a misplaced faith produces the departure of God's glory. Edmund Burke once said, "Superstition is the religion of feeble minds. Real faith goes beyond the things of God and rests its hope, puts its trust in God alone." Well, chapter 5 begins, "Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And when the Philistines took the ark of God, they brought it into the temple of Dagon and set it by Dagon." Ashdod was one of these city-states of the Philistines. And after they captured the ark, the Philistines brought the ark home to Ashdod to gloat over the victory they'd won and to mock Israel's God. Understand that in ancient times, a battle was not just a contest between two armies. It basically was whose God is bigger, my God or your God? And in the minds of the Philistines, their victory had proven that their God, Dagon, had proven more powerful than the God of the Israelites, Jehovah. This is why they bring the ark into the temple of Dagon. They set it next to their idol. Dagon was the fish god. His lower torso was like a fish. His upper torso was like a man. Something fishy about this guy. And though the ark was just a reminder and a representation of God, nevertheless, God is about to use the ark to make a point to the Philistines. They may have defeated Israel's army, but Israel's God remains unconquered. They're about to find that out. "And when the people of Ashdod arose early in the morning, there was Dagon fallen on his face to the earth before the ark of the Lord." Dagon bowing before the ark. The disciples of Dagon, they get up in the morning, they find the fish god bowing down before the ark of Jehovah. It seems a little fishy to them. They chalk it up as just an accident. "Hey, we'll set him back up. We'll try it again tomorrow morning." And so they took Dagon and they set it in its place again. And when they arose early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. The head of Dagon and both the palms of its hands were broken off on the threshold. Only the torso of Dagon was left on it. This is not a mere accident. This is more than an accident. The idol's head and hands have been broken off. Jehovah is proving that he is way ahead of Dagon. It's interesting. We often think it's up to us to defend God's reputation. Here his people have been unfaithful, and yet God sees to it that he gets the glory. God can defend himself. Verse 5, "Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor any who come into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day." Rather than admit the obvious and recognize the superiority of Jehovah God, the Philistines removed the ark and they created a tradition. No human was ever allowed to enter the floor of the temple of Dagon again. The priest stayed away from Dagon's statue. You know, it's easier to glue an idol back together than it is to admit your sin and change your lifestyle How many people have seen their idol crumble before them, only to glue it back together, only to try to patch it up and start it over? Like folks today, rather than open up the windows of their mind and their heart to God's truth, they prefer to glue it back together, just patch up that lifestyle once more, go back through the routine again. They prefer the stench of rotten fish to true faith in God. Well, verse 6 says, but the hand of the Lord was heavy on the people of Ashdod. The hands of Dagon had broken off, but the hand of the Lord had proven mighty. And here is the only time that I have ever been tempted to feel sorry for a Philistine, we're told. And he ravaged them and struck them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. Now, rather than the word tumors, if you're reading from the Old King James, it says emrods. Emrods. The Hebrew word literally means mound, a mound. And it comes from a word that means to swell. Here is where Bible commentators fall into two camps. Some understand the word tumors to mean hemorrhoids. Others think it referred to the bubonic plague, and we'll find out why in a minute. Famous classical Old Testament scholars, Kyle and Delitzsch, perhaps you've heard of them, they write this. According to the rabbis, it was a swelling of the rectum. Trapp puts it this way in his commentary, God was beating Dagon upon his own dunghill and smiting the worshipers on their hinder parts, paying their posteriors. God was paying their posteriors. Clark refers to it as the disease called the bleeding piles. In the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, verse 6 goes on to say, and the cities and the fields of all that region burst up, and mice were produced, and there was the confusion of a great death in the city. And this is why some people get the idea that the bubonic plague was part of it. I think the plague was probably a combination of both. That they were struck with a dire plague of hemorrhoids and also some kind of rat-induced disease. Hey, if this was hemorrhoids, friend, this is a severe, serious, bare-knuckled judgment from God. And remember, this is before the days of suppositories and Preparation H. No doubt about it, this is a no-holds-barred judgment. God hits below the belt. Literally. Here's a true story I clipped from the newspaper several years ago. Dateline, New York. A woman bedridden after hemorrhoid surgery became infuriated with her husband for leaving her alone while he went fishing and shot him to death when he got home, police said. Authorities said seeing her husband, Edward, traipse off with a cooler of beer to spend Sunday afternoon with his friends was too much for Gail Murphy, who was obliged to remain in bed on her stomach. When she heard him return 6 hours later, she got up, walked to the porch with a shotgun, and fired through the door, then called 911. Murphy, 47, died Monday morning. Now, if this woman was truly tried by a jury of her peers, and I mean fellow hemorrhoid sufferers, I am certain that Gail Murphy was found not guilty. No doubt about it. Imagine the whole city of Ashdod suffering from a pandemic of hemorrhoids. Everyone crabby and crotchety and upset. Everyone staying home and taking sitz baths. The consensus would be, man, we're outflanked.
Listening to Bible teaching here on the radio is a huge blessing that many of our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world simply don't have. We rejoice in this opportunity to share Pastor Sandy's messages with you. We do want to be sure to remind you that radio is not a church. Radio should be a complement to what God is already doing in your personal discipleship through the local body of believers that you're a part of. Maybe you're listening today and you don't have a home church. You've visited various places, but nothing seems to fit. First, if you live in the Atlanta, Georgia area, we want to personally invite you to join us for worship at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. We meet every Sunday morning at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. For more information, including driving directions, please log on to sandyadams.org and follow the link to the church website. Now, if you're listening outside of the Atlanta, Georgia area and are looking for a home church, we encourage you to log on to calvarychapel.com and find a Calvary Chapel in your area that teaches through the Bible just like Pastor Sandy does each day here on this program. Well, we wish we had more time today, but we've come to the close of today's broadcast. Be sure to remember to join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through God's Word. That's next time on Sandy Adams Radio.